a bit about Robert Capon's book, Exit 36. And I'm going to start with another book that you perhaps know better. Not many people could get to Exit 36, but I'm going to start with a book that you're supposed to have gotten to already. Because I think, as I read Exit 36, it is an exposition on 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17 to
where?
To 19. Familiar stuff. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. And all things are of God, who hath reconciled us to himself by Jesus Christ, and hath given to us the ministry of reconciliation, to wit, that God was in Christ, reconciling the world unto himself, not imputing their trespasses unto them, and hath committed unto us the word of reconciliation. I think Exit 36 is really a treatise on that. It is also a treatise on eschatology, the last things. And I guess the only reason I can be bold enough to want to share it with you all is that I think Exit 36 is also a whopping good treatise on the gospel. That's why I want to share it with you, not because it's so great on eschatology, although it's interesting on eschatology. The eschatology comes nicely packaged with a whole lot of gospel that will make it, I think, painless. Just a word or two about how I'd want to work at this. I really, believe me, honest engine, prefer to teach dialogically. When you got something to say, I hope to goodness you'll say it without waiting for me to pause, because I don't always pause. Please, I'm very interested in your comments, in your questions, in your critique, in whatever you would have to offer. And I'm hoping that you'll believe me and run with that. Just to get you warmed up a little bit and into the swing of things, will you please find somebody sitting somewhere near you, preferably somebody you don't know very well. So if you got a buddy on one side, turn to the other side. And spend the next couple minutes talking about what kind of feelings are evoked in you by the prospect of a discussion about death, judgment, heaven, and hell. What does that do to you as person to think that that's what we're going to talk about? You know, at least that's what old Bauermeister said. We're going to talk about death and judgment and heaven and hell. And where does that grab you? What I'm hoping is that where that grabs you right now will be changed somewhat after we're done with this discussion. So would you do that, please? Find somebody. If you can do it without getting up, fine. If you got to move, do that too. Go. I'm planning on 6 or 7 parts to this presentation. I'll begin with telling you just a bit about the author, who he is. That's cogent partly because I think the book is highly autobiographical. And then I'll tell you this is a novel, of all things. It's a very interesting way to do theology, by the way. It's a novel. And I'll tell you the story line. And I've got the characters up there on the board. Then I'd like to lift out of the novel some of that good gospel I was talking about. So it's really great stuff, I think. We'll see what you think. And then a short section on death, on judgment, and a section on heaven and hell together. And finally, if we have some time toward the end of our second hour, we'll spend a little time on some spare parts that I find in here that where Capon is you know, he's not paying attention to the main theme of the book. He's just kind of throwing in some little pearls that I'd like to share with you if there's time. So, first of all, Robert Capon, who wrote this thing, is an Episcopal priest in of all places, Port Jefferson, New York. Of all places, because that's where this novel takes place. He has written other theological books, if you've run across them. And he frequently does just what he's doing here. He weaves together the theology with something else. He's got one called Bed and Board, which is about family life and theology. He's got another one called The Supper of the Lamb, which is about cooking, of all things, and theology. And then a couple others that are pretty well known. The Third Peacock, and one I worked on last year here for a while, Hunting the Divine Fox, which he says both of those are clowning in the classroom plus theology. Father Capon is a parish priest of a small Episcopal parish in Port Jefferson, and he's also a seminary professor, part-time. Maybe that gives me some affinity to him, because I'm a seminary professor part-time. This book is, I think, highly autobiographical. It's about the Episcopal priest in Port Jefferson, New York, who also loves to cook, who also teaches at a seminary, who is the father of many children, and who is a fancier of fine wines and spirits, all of which describes Robert Capon. I find his style of theologizing very palatable. If you've ever picked up a theology book and thought, oh boy, you were probably right, because it's generally pretty heavy stuff. You know, you wade one page at a time, one paragraph at a time, find your mind drifting off, you know, and you've covered three pages and you don't remember a single thing except you were out there on a sailboat somewhere. When he does theology, because it's woven together with something else, it keeps your attention at least, and the theology sort of comes at you in snippets, which are digestible and often very palatable. My reason for offering this book is twofold. One, to share some thoughts about eschatology and gospel, and two, if you haven't been introduced to Capon, to introduce you to him and hopefully trick you into reading it. I think it's worthwhile. The story is about Father Bill Jansen. I don't know if you can see that, but it's kind of hard to move around. Father Bill Jansen is the parish priest in Port Jefferson, New York. His wife is Liz, sometimes called Elizabeth, and he makes an interesting distinction. When she's Liz, she's somebody to cook with and to do the dishes with and to, you know, do all those family tasks with. She's kind of a fixture, he says. When she's Elizabeth, then she is to be courted. That's just to give you a little flavor of who this goofy guy is. Father Bill Jansen also has an alter ego that he dialogues with occasionally, another self. That other self is really rather stuffy and called Arthur. We may give you bits of the dialogue with Arthur. The other main character in the book is Father Ted Jacobs, and his wife is Anne. Anne figures very prominently in the book. Then there's one more person who's very important in the book, and that is Pat Donahue. Married woman, member of Father Jacob's parish, estranged from her husband. A couple minor characters are Audrey, who is the friend, parishioner, and confidant of Father Jacob's, and then an old parishioner, a man named Peter, who is a Swedish carpenter, who dies. He does not play a very prominent role, but you'll hear more about Peter as we go along. The story is told by Father Jansen. It is about his pastoral care of Anne, wife of Ted Jacobs, and of Pat Donahue. The story is about pastoral care, therefore it's about everything that is. It's about love and scandal and sin and death and adultery and suicide, gossip and blame, hate and judgment, heaven and hell. But mostly the story is about God and about grace. It begins with a death notice. Father Jansen has died. He's a young man. I would guess him to be in his late 30s. He has died by his own hand. He ran his car into an abutment at exit 36, hence the name. The first person you meet, the first thing you read as you begin reading this book is like a death notice in the newspaper regarding Father Jacobs. The first person you meet is Pat. A love affair had been going on between Father Jansen and Pat for some years. Father Jacobs and Pat. Boy, I hope I don't keep mixing it up.
Yeah, you got them backwards the first time, too.
Ah, thank you. I'm glad somebody's on the ball. The teller of the story is Jansen.
Okay.
Who's dead?
Yeah.
Jacobs is dead.
Oh, okay. Who had a love affair?
Jacobs.
With Pat.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Jansen's a good guy, right?
Jansen's the teller of the story. You may think him good, you may think him whatever. I think him great. I really didn't plan it that way, but it worked very well because now you're ready to talk to me. And if I ever do this again, I'll try to make the same mistake. Thank you. We're going now. Pat comes because she's feeling guilty, and she's also feeling angry, and most of all, she's feeling loss. Even though the relationship between Pat and Ted was illicit, it still was full and strong and deep, and they had a very, very tenacious caring for each other. Father Jacobs had gotten himself into a bind. He had been doing something that he could not do. He had been loving two women in a way in which he could only love one. Later on, Father Jansen suggests that Ted also had a deeper problem within himself regarding his inability to face his own anger, that he had a repressed anger, a repressed rage even, if you will, that had been repressed for a lifetime, which pushed him and made him terribly vulnerable to the kind of temptation that Pat provided. It also made it impossible for him to forgive himself, therefore his suicide. That sounds like a lot of psychological talk, and this psychologist thinks it's pretty fair as psychological talk. Father Jansen is given the assignment from God, he says, of picking up the pieces after Ted's death. The pieces mainly belong to Ted and Ann and Pat. So, that's the story. That's what happens in the story. It's a story of this good priest's pastoral care to the people who were left after a suicide had occurred. The story has an odd ending. The book has an odd ending. It's two dreams that Father Jansen had very early on a Sunday morning, followed only by a cryptic conversation with Audrey, his confidant, who had appeared in one of the dreams. If those kind of dreams appear in biblical literature, we regard them as visions or revelations. If they appear in psychological literature, we regard them as synthesizing dreams that are a signal that some new ideational synthesis has taken place in the person who's dreaming, letting us know, I think, by this device, that Father Jansen finally had bought the whole system he's pushing around, theological system, the eschatological system he'd been pushing around through the entire book. So that's the story. this story in brief. Now, on to the gospel and something more interesting than the story. I think Capon has selected here two really biggie kinds of sins, hasn't he? Adultery and suicide. Can anybody in the room come up with a sin that's tougher for Christians to swallow than one of these? I can't. Can you? It's not just a rhetorical question. If you've got one, I'd like to hear it. I'll stop saying this. But I think in, you know, the Christian hierarchy of sins, adultery and suicide are way up there among the top ones. And then he takes these two sins and he attributes them, you know, not to some rummy down on a waterfront bar. He attributes them to a priest. I think the intention is to be somewhat mind-boggling. I think he knows who he's talking to when he constructs things this way. He's talking to us. He's talking to fellow Christians. Just for a minute, think, what would your reaction be if you went home from Holden to discover, one, that your pastor had just committed suicide, unquestionably suicide, suicide note, the whole works, and that he had been carrying on a love affair for 3 years before this occurred? What would that do to you? I think it'd blow most of us right out of the water. That would take some real shifting, some pulling and hauling to get used to, wouldn't it? I know it would for me. I think it would for most people. And I think he selected those two sins and attributed them to a priest for a very clear reason. He wanted to really wallop us, and I think he succeeds. Now, Capon knows who he's talking to. That's why he selects that. But just think for a minute. Now, with that kind of sin going, it's going to take some pretty strong gospel to turn this situation around. The very strongest. And I think that's exactly what it produces. Early on in the book, a little beyond where you got, unfortunately, there's a retelling of a parable. And I would like to read you that parable in King James, and then I'll read you the retelling of it. And you can get some of the feeling of punch that comes with Capon's brand of gospel. And Jesus answered and spake unto them again by parables and said, this is the parable of the wedding feast, those of you who know it by that name. The kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son. And he sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to the wedding, and they would not come. And again he sent forth other servants, saying, tell them which are bidden, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fatlings are killed, and all things are ready. Come unto the marriage. But they made light of it, and went their ways, one to his farm, another to his merchandise, and the remnant took his servants, and entreated them spitefully, and slew them. And when the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his armies, and destroyed those murderers, and burned up their cities. Then saith he to his servants, the wedding is ready, but they which were bidden were not worthy. Go ye therefore into the highways, and as many as ye shall find, bid them to the marriage. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found, both bad and good, and the wedding was furnished with guests. When the king came in to see the guests, he saw there a man which had not on a wedding garment. And he said unto them, friend, how camest thou in hither, not having a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, and take him away, and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's King James. Now, the same thing according to Capon. This is Father Jansen speaking, talking to Anne. The king who threw the wedding party for his son. First he invites all the classy friends, all the old money with the right connections and the right manners, and chauffeur-driven Bentleys and Givenchy gowns. The beautiful people who can really make a gorgeous gala evening, a reconciled perfect party. Well, they all give him chintzy excuses and beg off, so the king has one tremendous fit, writes them off as a bunch of deadbeats, and decides to make a reconciled party of his own. He sends out his servants and tells them to drag in anybody they can find. So the servants go down to the Bowery, and they round up a bunch of numbers runners, old whores, and drunks asleep in doorways with wine bottles in brown paper bags. They even get the grifter down on Christie Street who waits till your car is stopped for a light and then hits you for a dime not to wipe your windshield with a greasy rag. And then they bring this deluxe assortment of bums, tarts, and winos to the palace, and the king goes to work on them. He phones up the wardrobe mistress at the Royal Opera Company and has her send over all the costumes she can spare. Then he gives everybody a free costume at the door, tells them to go wash up and change. Any costume they like, any one at all. Well, the party starts, and it looks gorgeous. The champagne flows, the hors d'oeuvres never stop coming, and pretty soon some of the gorgeousness begins to rub off on the guests themselves. The drinks are free, so they stop cadging and swiping bags from each other. They catch glimpses of themselves in the mirror, and they're so surprised at how good they look, they actually start acting better. They use manners they thought they'd forgotten years ago. And everything goes fine until the king sees this one sourpuss standing next to the door with his costume in a heap at his feet. He goes over to him and he says, "What's wrong? Doesn't it fit? You don't like it? Take another." But he's grumpy and he won't answer. And the king tries again and says, "Come on, put it on, join the party." But he still won't talk. And then the king gets really mad and he says, "Look, Buster, this is my party, and I'm not going to have you louse it up for no reason. If you don't like it, you can leave." But the grouch won't leave either. So the king calls the royal bouncer and he says, "Marty, you see this punk here? Convince him that he can go to hell if he doesn't like my party, and convince him right now." You see, the point is, this is continuing now to Anne, the point is, there is nothing you need to do to get in. You only have to accept the reconciliation which has already been made for you. And above all, there is nothing you can do to keep from getting in. Those servants the king sent, they all carried pistols. The only way you can get out of the party is to refuse the reconciliation, to think that your own moral preoccupations or whatever are more important than putting on the free costume and joining the fun. Then he continues to Anne, "Nobody has to do any bookkeeping. Ted is reconciled already. Ted is the dead priest. And so are you, and the wife, and so am I. All we have to do is throw the ledgers in the trash can and get on with the party." For the first time, she showed a little surprise. "That doesn't sound particularly moral," says Anne. And Father Jansen's response, "Exactly. Most of the parables are made deliberately immoral. The elder son gets gypped." We've been working on that with Myron. "The elder son gets gypped. The people who worked all day aren't paid more than the ones who worked only 1 hour." That's the laborers in the vineyard. "Just to make the point that it's the mystery of reconciliation that's the main thing, not the moral bookkeeping." I think that's pretty hearty kind of gospel. Got a couple more. Since this book deals with suicide, he needs to address, how do you get grace to a suicide? He says, "When I was a new priest, you wore black for a requiem. Grim. Even for the faithful departed, you sang Dies Irae, which is Day of Wrath, O Day of Mourning." And he terms that the good news of salvation musically arranged to scare the hell out of you. "And for the unfaithful departed, for those who had, quote, laid violent hands upon themselves, you weren't even allowed to use that. In place of the regular rite, you were supposed to piece together something that would give as much comfort as possible to the living, consistent with your obligation to remain conspicuously noncommittal about the fate of the deceased. Most of us at least had the grace to be embarrassed. We used the prayer book right anyway. Still, we felt obliged to explain to ourselves that it was really all right because, who knows, maybe Uncle Arthur got in a couple seconds worth of repentance between the Brooklyn Bridge and the river. That worked until you found out he shot himself. Then it was time to hunt for another rationalization. Unbelievable. As if bits of the ethical brickwork just before the edge of the abyss were more important than the dead Christ at the bottom. How do you like that? The bits of ethical brickwork, you know, your saying of repentance right before you fall into the abyss is more important than the dead Christ at the bottom. Damned nonsense. The reconciliation of all things in heaven and earth made subsidiary to nitpicking about the last minute state of some poor bastard's conscience. Where did the church get her knack for putting the main thing last, her genius for solemn high distractions? That's got the gospel for suicides, I think. Then another little piece about how the reconciliation works. The Christ who has died, and here's, and I'm glad you raised that, because that probably got past a lot of folks. The dead Christ at the bottom means that Christ is eternally dead as Christ is eternally alive. And what we're into now is Capon's understanding of time and eternity. Okay? And we'll fill that in a little more later on. Time refers to us, period. Eternity refers to God, period. We are all held in God's constant now. Eternity is not an endless string of days. Eternity is a forever now. Okay? If you never bounce those ideas around before, they're going to sound very strange, but stick with them. We'll come back to them later on and fill it in a little more, maybe, with a little luck. That's what he means by the dead Christ at the bottom. The sacrifice of Christ is eternal. Christ's death is eternal. Christ's resurrection is eternal. Because God is eternal. Everybody else all right? Chris isn't all right yet, but... okay. Then he says, don't worry excessively about the spiritual danger of getting something for nothing, when he's talking about the reconciliation. There is no such thing as a free lunch. The price of every item on the menu, the price of every kind of forgiveness, every kind of grace, is the same for everybody, good or bad. It is one crucifixion. No credit cards accepted. Pay the waiter. Subcategory under gospel, you know, how does, okay, so there's gospel now. It is the reconciliation. It is the wedding garment that is offered you so that you can come to the feast. The feast is already going. And this wedding garment is out there, the wedding garment being the reconciliation for you. Now, how does one get this? Subcategory we would call faith. And here's where Peter comes in. Peter is very saintly, a very good, hardworking, humble, pious man. And this is what his priest says about him.
Is this that Swede that you talked about?
Yeah, this was the good Swede, right. Thank you for lifting that up. Peter was a crystal clear example of the way Christians are supposed to believe, and a rebuke to the way most of us do. He didn't believe that, or believe because, or believe in order to. He just trusted Jesus. Most of the whole story, even if you're a smart-ass theologian, Most of us are so busy with philosophy that we never get around to faith. We say we believe, but when we try to say what we believe, we start handing ourselves a lot of metaphysical scaffolding instead of Jesus. We say we believe in the order of the universe, or in the goodness of God, or in God's plan for our lives. But then a bad day comes along. The universe has no more order than a dump, and God is beating a tar out of us, and his plan looks as if he forgot to make it. So we have a giant crisis of faith and tell everybody we've lost our faith. But we didn't lose our faith. All we lost was some jury-rigged philosophy that couldn't stand up to the weather. The point is that all that kind of thing, by necessity, is purely our own devising, no matter how good it is. It's got no more strength than we have, and most of the time, it's got a lot less. That's our philosophizing. Still, we go right on trying to use it for armor. We build ourselves little philosophical Sherman tanks and drive around in them, pleased as punch at our invulnerability. But then the engine breaks down, or the tread falls off, or the gas runs out, and there we sit, seedy and by ourselves. There is only one thing for all that aloneness, and that is Jesus alone. Not faith in God, because you don't know beans about God for sure. And not faith in what Jesus means, because all you've got to filter his meaning through is an old, used teabag of a mind that unclarifies everything. Not even faith in what Jesus said, because even if he actually said it all word for word, it still gets to you only through your myopic eyes and tin ears. All that kind of faith, unless you're unlucky and it doesn't fall apart on you, is about as much support as a rotten floor. The only real support is Jesus. Jesus, 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 period, period, period. Ah, you want to know what I meant by that. And obviously, as a theologian, I shall open my big mouth and try to tell you at probably nauseating length. But not here. Here you are only going to get the one thing Peter needed to know. Jesus. The one unfiltered reality. Unfiltered because if you don't run it through your mind, you just say yes to it. Not yes because, just yes. Period. Or no, period, as you like. The vocabulary of faith has only two words, and both of them are addressed only to the man on the cross. Where that all takes you, of course, is a matter for endless discussion, and you land right back in the theological tank building business the minute you start. It's inevitable and quite harmless, but only so long as you remember that nothing you say is any better than you are, and you're not so hot. So just Jesus, yes. Jesus, Jesus, yes. While my alter ego isn't looking, that's Arthur. However, let me slip you one really good theological tidbit under the table. The smallest, strongest Sherman tank in the world. If Jesus, everything. If not Jesus, nothing. Arthur, why is it you always hit the nail once too often? Now you've put a hammer mark on a perfectly good piece of work. Skip a little section here and go down to the end of this chapter. You can't take anybody's theological language too seriously, especially your own. Use it all. Discard it all. Pick it all up again and start over. It never saved anybody anyway, so you're not going to do that much harm or good with it. Just Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Any reaction to us so far? How do you like the gospel according to Capon?
Well, I'd like to know a little more about that guy.
Which guy?
Peter. Jesus,
okay, I can't tell you much because he doesn't tell me much. Admired by everybody. He has a way of handling gossip. that I noted and can probably get back to you. Let me see. That
might not put you on the spot.
No?
I might just put the note out there, you know. You wonder about this person, what makes them tick, and
oh.
That's what I'm asking.
That remains pretty much a mystery, what makes him tick. Very good man, respected by all. The thing about gossip, as a carpenter and a handyman, he was in and out of lots of houses in the parish, and people would fill him with all kinds of gossip, but he never carried it. He just absorbed it. He didn't take it any further. And that is seen as one of his virtues, because he could have really been spreading a lot of stuff all over town, but he didn't. Saintly, faithful. Father Jansen says nothing was ever wrong with the physical structure. You know, there weren't nails sticking up, there weren't broken things here and there, because they were fixed before you noticed them, as long as Peter was around. And once Peter was gone, nothing was ever right.
Well, who hit the nail too much? Peter or...
Arthur.
Arthur,
yeah.
I see, okay.
When he sneaks in that tidbit under the table, the best Sherman tank of all. And Arthur is Jansen's alter ego. Arthur is the one that Jansen, when he's talking to himself. I'm sorry if that was confusing. Further reactions to the gospel according to Capon.
Isn't he saying to somebody like you who's been studying all these theological topics and issues and, you know, you spent years being involved in that, isn't he kind of saying, well, that was all nice, but, you know, you didn't really need to do all that?
Oh, yeah, that's what he said.
I mean, somebody like you, yeah.
I agree. I think he's right.
And all of us as individuals then can get caught up in our own, driving our own Sherman tanks.
Oh yes, and running them into each other.
Yeah, and really what the basis and the basic line of our life should be Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And who he is and who we are in relationship. Is that kind of what he's saying to us?
Mm-hmm. Not so much even who he is as that he is.
Oh, that he exists.
That he
that
is.
That he is real. That he is.
Mm-hmm. That he's as much as we can know about God, and there he is, as the church holds him up to us. He has some pretty sharp words for the church. You heard a couple of them. There are some juicier ones. Where he, you know, he's not, he sees the church as very essential, but is bungling its job most of the time, or much of the time, covering up the main thing with all kinds of other things, sin lists, stuff like that.
Yes, yeah, since at the same time he takes pot shots at Sherman tanks, sounds like he also acknowledges that he continues to build them.
Oh, he does. Yes, he builds a lot of them.
And almost, you know, as though it's possible every now and then to stand back away from them and say, go ahead, build them away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Build them for all you're worth and let them go out there and run into each other and take pot shots at each other and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, let those that survive, survive, and let those that fall, fall. Build some more for them that's fallen, and you know, let's get on about the business.
That's how he, you've caught it. That's how he describes his teaching style at the seminary. Not in those words, but that's when he talks about how he teaches, that's what he does.
But don't you also find out which of the Sherman tanks are real and valuable and valid, because they don't get shot at or crumpled as they bump in? I mean, they last the test of confrontation. I mean, in that sense, you build a doctrine or a foundation about this Jesus,
mm-hmm.
on which you base your life. I mean, aren't there tanks that withhold, withstand against the bump?
Jesus, 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 period, 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 I think.
Yeah, but there still is a body of knowledge and experience that with that can't be shot down because it's real for you.
Part of the problem, part of the problem of theology, and this is explained by Capon very beautifully in Hunting the Divine Fox. If you ever get your mitts on that one, gobble it up because it's great stuff. He begins with an analogy. He says, you know, when we talk theologically, when we talk about God, we have to realize that we're speaking metaphorically or analogically. We cannot speak directly about God, or we barely can. And the picture he draws then is of a clam and a rock and a starfish on the bottom of the ocean who are trying to describe a ballerina to each other. And he says, that's about the way it is when we try to talk about God. You know, a starfish can move around at least. The clam can't and a rock can't at all. The clam's alive. The rock isn't. Imagine that conversation. That's the equivalent of our theologizing, if you will, our discussing about God. The best we can get, you know, is a triangulated shot at it, where we have some idea where it is. That's about as good as we do, ever. Therefore, the Sherman tanks, you know, ought to be blown up and shot at and seen for as much as they have, but not seen for more. Mm-hmm. On to the subject of death. Now here we really get into some of the heavy stuff in the book. The meaning of death, how is death to be seen by the Christian? And Capon makes the point that death is to be seen as offering, not as robbery. Think of it, just those two words juxtaposed, as offering instead of robbery. Death is very often seen as robbery. He has to back up a little bit philosophically and then fill in. Death is not an accident in creation. I don't know if that's really necessary for where he's taking us, because I haven't thought that true enough. You might be able to help me do that. Lots of Lutheran theology about theologizing about death says that death is the result of sin, that there was no death at creation, that death entered after the fall. That's what I think most of us were taught. Capon is saying that's not the case. Death was part of creation from the beginning. It did not enter as an accident later, the way with the entrance of sin. It's a natural part of creation. It was to be handled in a particular way. The model of handling death is Christ, not Adam. Adam dies, and his death is a robbery of him. It is a taking away of something from him. Christ dies, not just sacrificially, but as the priest who makes his death an offering to God. Capon's point is that our death is to be an offering to God. If we can understand it not as a robbery. Now, that's interesting, because in the novel, it comes in a context, you know, these thoughts come in a context of the suicide of a priest and the death of a very honorable old man. The quiet release in death of a very honorable old man. Let me give you that part Father Jansen's last interaction with Peter before his before he dies. Peter has had his second heart attack. That's what gets him to the hospital. And Father Jansen had called on him when he first learned of that, and now he's back there again. I got back there on Thursday. He was completely alert. Would I hear his confession? I turned the two-colored stole over to the purple side. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. The Lord be in thy heart and upon thy lips. He was guilty, he said, since his last confession, which was before Easter, of being impatient and irritable at times. For these and for all of the sins he could not now remember, he was truly sorry and asked pardon of God and of me, Father, penance, counsel, and absolution. Here's a great line. I just gave him the absolution. He has no penance or counsel for him. What are you supposed to say to someone like him? He confesses minor flaws in his most noble virtues. It is like listening to Shakespeare criticize infelicities in John of Gaunt's speech. You're out of your league, Arthur. After I had communicated him, we talked a little. I don't think I'm going to make it this time, Father. That's not your business, Peter. Everyone's pulling for you. Just go easy. You've made it before. Yeah, sure. But this is too much trouble. I've had a good life, and Isabel doesn't need a sick old man around her neck. That's his wife. I'm ready to go whenever it's time. Jesus can just do me a favor and take me. He already has you, and Isabel, and me, and the whole world. Well, any time he wants to finish up my corner of it, I'll be happy to help. I'm ready to go. I know you are, Peter. You're great. See you tomorrow. Yeah, sure. Out in the parking lot, a Volvo had pulled up next to my Camaro. In my mind's eye, a quick cut to the TV commercial. We build them the way we build them because we have to. Swedish craftsmanship. Do you see in there, sprinkled in with the jokes, a man's attitude towards his death. An attitude that maybe somebody 15 might be able to take, that maybe somebody 47 might be able to take, that maybe you might be able to take today, because it's been laid out for you. The attitude of offering rather than robbery towards one's own death.
You used Adam's death as the example of robbery. How is our death different than that?
Aha! I didn't set him up to ask that question. Thank you. Because our death is bound into Christ's death. Which was the offering to God. And our death is not something that is foisted upon us. It is something that has always been part of what was going to be our experience, whenever it occurs.
So in other words, the death since Christ's death has the offering aspect.
Our death because of Christ's death. And remember, Christ is God, therefore his death is eternal, as his life is eternal. The eternal word applies to Christ. It does not apply to us. It applies to him. It applies to us through him. This kind of thinking, you know, we recognize, don't we? I think that it has some scriptural warrant in God knowing us before our birth, created Christ before the foundation of the world, all that kind of scriptural talk, which is just kind of laid there for most of us, I think, without us ever really grasping it and taking it seriously. We thought, well, you know, that's Bible talk and I don't dig it. What Capon's doing, I think, by making this distinction between eternal and time-bound, is showing us how to make some sense out of that sort of Bible talk. Let me read you a short section on that. If I bring in the notion of eternity at all, I want to use it full strength in the only place where it makes sense, as an attribute of God and nothing else. I want to break the habit of imagining that it's some kind of supratemporal, supraspatial continuum, a sort of infinitely extending tapioca pudding floating around out there beyond the fringes of time and space. Okay? I want to allow it to refer only to God's personal style of doing business, to his way of holding at once, in one single, simple now, everything that all of time from start to finish has ever held. Did you get all that? That was a long sentence. The trick will be, scrupulously, to avoid thinking of it as if it were some strange new endless time strung out beyond these times. I never want to let eternal life refer to anything but these short times themselves, as they are held by God in a different way than time holds them. Get all that? Because if you don't keep a watertight bulkhead between eternity and time, the leakage of temporality into eternity will seep into your religion and eventually sink your theology. Anything said on this side of the bulkhead must be in strict accordance with the rules of time. Anything on the far side, with the rules of eternity. Thus, Ted began here in 1935 and ended here in 1973. So much and nothing more for the temporal Ted. But in God, who holds him eternally in one single now, there was never a time when he hadn't already thought of Ted, never a time when he hadn't already caused him to be, never a time when he hadn't already watched his foot go down on the accelerator in the act of causing himself not to be. As a matter of fact, those events, so discreetly successive here, are not successive in God at all. They are all at once in his eternity. They are not really, for him at least, even events. An event is something that comes out, turns out, happens. There was a time when it wasn't, then there is a time when it is. But God, as God, is not locked into time as we are. The act by which he causes each temporal thing to be is an eternal act. It is not something he thought of doing a very long time ago and then one day finally got around to plugging in. It is something he always does and something always present to his eternal being. Now, that was kind of a long, heavy section, but did you track with it at all? Do you see the distinction he's making? Do you see how he is conceptualizing of God and of eternity and of us? Word games?
I said yes.
Shoot.
Huh?
Shoot.
Well, I said word game. You said word games and I said yes.
Uh-huh.
I agree. He was talking word games.
All right. Say on.
Oh, so?
No, okay.
Could I go back to this offering? Or
by all means.
Do you want to continue the eternity thing? It seems to me that if one is going to offer, think of death as offering yourself, you would have had to have reached, first of all, the acceptance stage that Kubler-Ross speaks of. And secondly, the way I can see it, you would almost have to be a Christian or someone who acknowledges God to get to this point.
Yeah, I would agree. Oh, yeah, I think...
So, I mean, this experience and this rationale, this feeling, this intention of offering is not reality for everybody.
True. True. Death is robbery for most. For the Christian, it does not need to be robbery. Death can be offering.
If it's offering.
For the Christian, then death is not the enemy. You know, the statement, death is the enemy. For the Christian, death is not the enemy.
Yeah, you got to be a little careful with that. If I'm expounding Capon, I think Capon's answer to is death the end would be a very loud, of course not.
Not the end, the enemy.
The enemy, oh, okay. Right, death is not the enemy. The sting of death is sin, the strength of sin is the law. That's the enemy, sin, and the law which sharpens it and judges us. Please.
If you speak, I mean, speaking of death as an offering, that implies something that we are offering. And yet,
yes.
then we're taking, but we don't do anything. I mean, Christ takes us.
Offering in the sense that we are all priests, in that we raise up to God what He has given us. He gives us life, He gives us strength, He gives us children, He gives us food, and all of this we offer up. Okay? Including death. I was interested, was it night before last, at Vespers, we sang a hymn that I had never sung before, that St. Francis hymn. And one of the later stanzas was about death. Mm-hmm. And about all, well, the opening stanza was all the creatures of God are to praise Him. And one of the creatures was death, which was to praise Him. At least that's the only way I could make sense out of it. Isn't that what it says? God's creature, death, is to praise Him. This moves me such a long, long way from my own roots, you know. I'm the kid who, at seminary, with a singing group, learned to sing Komm Sieser Tod and knew enough German to know what that meant. And didn't like singing it because, you know, come sweet death, what's sweet about death? But there it was, there was that idea of death, not as robbery, in that old German hymn, of all places. But death is possible offering.
We tie death into a point. And kind of put these two kind of ideas together. We tie death to a point in life, linearly.
Yes.
I hear Capon saying in that sense that that death as offering is taking the whole of being of that person. In that kind of non-lineal sense,
yes,
in God's eternity, and say, there it is.
Uh-huh. It's 5 o'clock, and I'm uneasy about quitting because I think we're just really starting to roll, but it's time to quit. And we pick up tomorrow morning at 9:15, correct?
Don't ask me.
What's coming is maybe a little more on death and some one thing in this book that I've never encountered anywhere in any kind of book, and that's what I'd like to lead off with tomorrow morning. Father Jansen tells about a time that twins were born to him and his wife, and one was stillborn and the other died after 24 hours, and his burial of those two. It'll give you a new look at death. You know, my God, what else, you know, what could be more tragic? And to just have a look at that with him, that's where we'll start. And we go on to delightful topics like judgment and hell, and if we have time, a few bits and pieces. Thank you for your attention.